that's what's interesting to me here, is just how you can share data in a way that makes sense, in a way that benefits a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Some of that's a challenge from how you differentiate yourself. How are you able to make a difference in sharing your data and sharing your unique story and sharing your research? Sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're first, sometimes you're better, sometimes it's a lot of different things. Luck is going to play a role, but you can't be lucky without being good.
Hello again. Lee Brooks here from Cromulent Marketing with another episode of the Community Podcast. I'm joined today by Dan Deeth, the Senior Manager of Corporate Communications at eCentier, who are a pure-play managed detection and response service provider in the cybersecurity space. Dan and I worked together for many years at Sandvine, and he joined me to share his well of knowledge and experience with PR, media and analyst relations, and data-driven thought leadership.
Dan, do you want to introduce yourself to our listener?
Not really, but this is, I'm Dan Deeth. I currently am employed at eCentier. I'm the Senior Manager of Corporate Communications. I used to be Director of Corporate Communications at Sandvine. There was a short jaunt in between there, which we don't need to go into. And it sounds like I was fired. I just didn't like the experience there so much. And yeah, so I do lots of stuff here. I do analyst relations. I help with some of our public relations activities surrounding, particularly around threat intelligence and kind of the thought leadership pieces around threats and what our SOC does. And then other things as they come about, just kind of jack of all trades, master of none is probably what will go on my tombstone.
There's that self-deprecation that we were just talking about.
Master of nothing, yeah.
And you do it all from the fabulous new offices.
Yeah, so now everyone knows we're in the eCentier office.
I signed in at reception.
There you go. So, yeah, a new office in here, 65,000 square feet, heart of Waterloo, old BlackBerry building. It's state-of-the-art, as you saw, cubes and cubes and cubes, but beautiful facility and cool to be back in Waterloo. Waterloo's fun to be in because all my friends are here. That's really what I get excited about, being around people that I know.
Mm-hmm. Several in this extended building.
Several in this extended competitors who are friends, and past colleagues who are friends, and former employees who are friends.
Is that something that ever comes up? Just the fact that there's quite a density of security companies. A lot of attention hits the region now for AI,
yeah.
And there's now there will soon be a med tech group facility. I can't remember.
I saw the announcement. Which
is cool. I think cooperation is great when there isn't direct competition. Quite a few of the security companies, though, there is more competition and overlap.
Yeah, there's a lot of security companies here now. Like, if you think about maybe where the genesis of the region now is a lot of people will point to BlackBerry as being a big reason for a lot of the smaller companies here today. And BlackBerry is now essentially a security company, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's the biggest one. And then you've got large American companies having some smaller offices here. So in this building is McAfee, I'm never really sure how it works.
Right? John McAfee?
I don't think they like to be associated with that fellow.
However he pronounces his name, we're gonna do the
Symantec, right? Has an office here via an acquisition. We have a colleague that works there. We have a competing company in the same space, like right next door to us. Security is a hot area,
and then there are startups. Like if you look through the sort of the long tail list of tech companies in Waterloo, there are quite a few who are doing some sort of very specific security.
Yeah, like our good friend Don at Agilicus. I can never say the name out loud. So no shortage of security companies in town. So it's a cool space to be in. Mm-hmm. It's a growth space just in the industry, right? Like if you look at M&A activity broadly, right? As we sit here and tell you, as we're talking earlier, the Broadcom is in advanced talks to buy Symantec. Right? Yeah. That's going to be a massive acquisition. Yeah. But like, there's acquisitions on acquisitions all the time.
Are we breaking that news?
No, we're not. I'm more interested in breaking Kawhi Leonard choosing to go to like the Lakers and just be really sad about it. So yeah, security is a growth space here, and in Waterloo is the place to be. So
you want to have knowledge sharing because every company benefits from people learning and staying up to date with the field and new technologies and approaches. But at the same time, there's sensitivity to the proprietary. And that might be maybe one of the themes that will emerge in our chat today is proprietary stuff versus the stuff outside the building that everyone, the rising tide.
Yeah, so the one thing that's interesting is that I've grown to kind of appreciate is from the threat intelligence side, that's the people that work in our SOC or Security Operations Center. You know, they interact all the time with a bunch of people at what we consider competing companies in terms of information sharing. So the idea that when they find a threat, they'll share that with a broader community so that everyone can protect themselves.
Yeah.
And that's really, really interesting the way that works.
This is almost like the vulnerability disclosures, right? Like the white hat hackers.
Some of the CVEs of the common availability stuff. So yeah, the idea is that in theory we can share things that are happening out externally. There's some stuff that we proprietarily keep for a little bit to make sure that our customers are protected before we release that to the larger community. But yeah, there's this idea that from the threat intelligence side that you give and you get. And by giving and getting, because the end goal of all these companies working in security, it's yes, you want to be profitable. Yes, you want to be successful. Yes, you want to do all these things. But your end goal is to protect your customers or protect the people.
Yeah.
And the best way to do that is share that information, because if you kept it all to yourself, you know, what good does that do your customers? Yeah. And what does that good do to anyone? And so there's a lot of, I'm still learning. I've been here 8 or 9 months now.
Yeah, that comes as a surprise to me, someone outside. And I didn't realize there was that level of cooperation or information.
And there's a big thing on like sharing credit. So we recently published some research on a new type of malware, and we have a PR agency and we were able to get some news coverage for it, right? But the one thing that keeps hammering back is from the people I work with is make sure we cite the original discoverer and the different variants and making sure you give credit back, which I mean, it's the most common sense thing.
Yeah.
But something that I would never have thought about. I'd just be like, oh, we discovered this new thing, this new element, this new infrastructure based on a different variant of malware, but let's talk about this.
Yeah.
But they're like, no, let's like give props to people down the chain. And it makes sense, and it's absolutely the right thing to do. It's just they're ingrained in the way that they operate and in the way they engage in this community.
It's automatic.
Yeah, it's just common sense for them. Where in a past life, we very much had proprietary information. There was no, at Sandvine, right? We had a set of data. We had a bunch of network data that not a lot of other people had.
Yeah.
And so we couldn't share with other people to like, hey, what are you seeing? And if we did share, what was the benefit to everyone? There wasn't really anyone. Where security data, there's this value in that a rising tide helps all boats or whatever I know what the ones I want to say, but I'm bad at
people in glass houses sink ships.
Yeah, sure, whatever, right? So I'm no rocket surgeon. So, you know, that's what's interesting to me here is just how you can share data in a way that makes sense, in a way that benefits a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And then some of that's a challenge from how you differentiate yourself in some of the activities we do around like, how are you able to make a difference in sharing your data and sharing your unique story and sharing your research when other people have the access to the exact same data? Sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're first, sometimes you're better, sometimes it's a lot of different things. And so that's like one of the challenges I'm enjoying here is just...
Yeah. Or do you specialize in a particular element of security?
A particular
niche, a particular capability, a particular market vertical.
Yeah. And that's kind of the opportunity of it. And we're still in the process of carving that out, right? We serve a lot of mid-market companies. And so when we talk about mid-market, we're talking kind of 50 to 500, 50 to 5,000 seats, bums, employees, right? And so they're the type of people that have enough revenue, they have data they need to protect, but they don't have in-house security expertise. And so they'll look to outsource it. And the nature of threats, too, is they're 24/7, right? There's no stopping the hackers, right? The company, you know, the countries that are known for more.
I think you're thinking of a single gentleman in a basement.
I mean, countries that are actively more hostile, and that's, you know, are in totally different time zones. And, you know, people that maybe are concerned about people in their basement, they operate, you know, they're up at 4 a.m. And, like, how do you protect? You can't, you're a small or medium business, you can't have someone staffing your network 24/7.
Yeah.
You can't wait to show them at 8 a.m. the next day. Oh, something happened 3 hours ago.
Yeah.
You're screwed. And then you can't find the people to sit in those seats anyways. And how do you pay them? And they're just in demand, right? And so that's kind of what our service does here is we help protect other people because we hire the people. We train them. We work with the best people to get the best data. We build the best technology. And that's how you basically pay us to kind of take some of the worry off you. And then you help have peace of mind, your business is secured, you meet regulatory requirements, do all that types of stuff.
So we've talked quite a bit about the present day.
Mm-hmm.
Let's roll it back a little bit. And many years ago, there was a young Mr. Deeth, and he was working at Centennial College.
Centennial College? Yeah, that's like way back in the day, yeah.
Yeah.
We're going back in time,
We are. I mean, every role you've had has been communications.
For the most part.
Yeah. I mean, I guess with the possible exception, you instruct at Conestoga College, and that's more project management, or is that communication?
Well, it's communications essentially in project management.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what have you seen I mean, we could quickly run through them. Centennial College, then you were at Research in Motion.
Yeah.
You went to Bruce Power, so you're at the nuclear plant.
I chose to leave all. I chose to leave. It was like a there are no gaps in that resume.
You're also, you know, you're also, yeah, you're a seasoned professional.
Sure.
You're not 2 years into your career, right? You've had enough time to get some notches in the belt, and that was when you came over and joined Sandvine.
Yeah,
I remember interviewing you for that, and we talked about Super Bowl ads.
Yeah, that was pretty much the best review I have ever had.
And then there was the sort of interlude that you alluded to before, and then eCenter. So all of those they've all been communications roles.
Yeah.
They were PR, media, analyst. I'm curious, what have you seen over the years? What insights can you provide into how those activities, those functions have changed from what your audiences are looking for?
Sure. So I think one of the things that, I mean, has evolved over time. So I guess my PR activity, so we can go back through time. So my first job, I was at a college in Toronto, Centennial College. My job was to go and talk to prospective students, not about coming to the college, but just about like, have you thought about college? Because there's this group of...
Grow the pie.
Yeah, basically is what it was. It was basically you'd go and talk to people, and parents were like, my son or daughter's going to university. And you'd be like, okay.
I'm so disappointed.
Right. And there's nothing. And then you'd be like, have you heard about college though? Like, so you want to be a paramedic. Guess how you go. You got to go to college.
Yeah.
Or, oh yeah, your son or daughter can go get an English degree. But, you know, when they graduate, what are they going to do? Maybe they want to come back into a post-grad program. Mm-hmm. Or have you heard about that colleges have degrees and they're like really a mix of hands-on stuff. And so my job was to just go and tell that story. And so
I wasn't open their eyes.
Yeah. And so that was like really fun. You got to travel a bit. And so, you know, that was, you know, talking to students. And I guess the one thing, you know, what has changed over time is, I guess I've dealt with a bunch of different audiences, but I learned quickly in that job was just, there was no, I guess I come back to, in all of the jobs I've had, I've emphasized honesty and straightforwardness. Like, I'm not really the type of person to be a bad, never one to lie to a person or try to sway them the wrong way.
It's not a good long-term strategy, deceit.
No, right. And so I think that's, and we'll get to the PR stuff soon, and that's always been my, and it's not deceit, it's just like, there's just, people appreciate being genuine, and I think that's, goes for a reporter, goes for anyone. And so when you're talking to parents, you just be like, oh yeah, your kid can go to university. I'm just going to tell you about college. And if you remember this chat in 5 years' time, cool, and come back. Mm-hmm. And so I think when it comes to PR or public relations or analyst relations, my approach has always been, and where I think if I've been effective in any way, it's just that very easy to work with. You don't try to hard sell anyone. You give people just the truth, and you're easy to work with, and you get back to people quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the common thread I've seen in every job I've had, where I think I swerve to naturally. It's just that if you give people information that you think will be beneficial to them in a way that they want it, they can choose to use it or choose not use it, or mm-hmm. choose to act on it, choose not to act on it. And that's how you'll be successful. And so as we now are in an era where you're looking at publications, newspapers, you know, they're losing reporters all the time. You're seeing online publications more and more rely on advertorials or paid digital stuff to get in there.
Placed articles.
Placed articles and things like this. To be a company and to be a person who, when you're dealing with the reporters who are still running independent work, to be someone who comes with facts first, doesn't try to give a hard spin to people, just says, hey, I think this is interesting, doesn't pitch everything to everyone. I think those are the where I've seen things evolve and where still people get successful. Now we have an agency here, which I never have worked with before, and they're great at doing that as well. So, you know, I actually don't have to do as much outreach anymore directly to media. You know, ones that we do have relationships with, I'll deal with them, and the agency does a lot of the work, and they're like, they crush it. And for the longest time I was like, who needs an agency? Like that at Sandvine, we didn't have an agency and we just rested on relationships. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, once the person with the relationships leaves, what do you have?
Yeah.
And how do you build those things up?
Yeah.
And so I was fortunate there, but
yeah, so the agency is an insulation against that.
Yeah. And they're way more better at their job than I am. Right. Like they know security better than me. They know everything better than me. And let's be clear, we have a dedicated PR person here as well, who does a corporate product, all these things, and does a great job at that too. My little niche of it is just threat intelligence and these reports that we write. And I'm still so new to this. Like, we've done 2 reports since I've gotten here, and I've had a little bit of hands on them. Right. But just in my little bit of time here, it's you know, the same tenants want as people. People want new information. They want it digestible, because they're also, the media is also under pressure to turn stories around.
Yeah,
I need to write 2 or 3 stories a day.
You mentioned earlier getting back to them quickly.
Yeah, well, it's just timely. And so yeah, you know, one of the strengths I think I've had, and the agency we're blessed with, is that they're very technically adept. And so being able to, when a reporter comes back with a question, being able to get that answer back yourself and not have to go down the chain. Well, let me go talk to the engineer. Let me go talk to these people.
Yeah.
If you understand the material and can go back to people, it helps people when they're on deadline. Because when it comes to journalism, they're always on deadline. Yeah. They're always like, I got to get my 2 stories out today. I got to hit the publish button at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
And you, like every project you're like in school, but like, you know, your essays are due at 8 a.m. report, and you hand it in at 7:58. Reporters are always working against deadline. It's just this constant rush.
And, yep.
And so in a busy world, you work to deadlines.
Yeah.
And so you want to help those people out as much.
So you're appreciating how they work, what it is that's important to them, and being easy to work with.
Yeah. And, you know, there are a bunch of people who will just pitch and pitch and pitch everything to people.
Yeah.
And why, if I were a reporter, I wouldn't want to listen to that. I will only go to a reporter, like some of my pitches in the past life, and again, I are like, hey.
And to be clear, in the Sandmine days, there was a lot of success in terms of getting into major international industry, business, technology, publications.
Yeah, so the first thing first is that we were lucky to have a data set that was interesting to a lot of people.
Well, I guess my point there is, you're making it... Someone unfamiliar with your work in history might think, okay, well, once or twice a year you pitched something and it got carried.
Yeah.
It's like, which isn't the case. We were...
Our batting average is like the 700-800s.
Yeah.
Like, if we had a type piece of research, but part of that
and
was...
And they were calling you. Like, oh, yeah, something happened on the internet. Some company related to online traffic did something. Can you please comment?
Basically. But so we were, the genesis of that, and you know, this is... whatever you started in 2010, 2011, right? We started doing the reports, and they evolved over time. And eventually I ended up doing them all, creating these reports, right? And so you become, all of a sudden, I have access to basically the world's internet usage data at a network level, not subscriber stuff, right? I understand the data. I have an interest and enthusiasm for internet trends. And all of a sudden I'm talking to the media about it, and I have the data, and I can answer questions, and I can, you know, tell people that it's interesting. And then all of a sudden you give them data they want, they write a story, they see the metrics, they say, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And they come back to you. And then as your data proves reliable, you build this relationship over time. And it goes from, okay, the first few times they write on your data, your reports, they got a lot of questions.
Yeah.
It might be a phone call, might be some email back and forth. But at the end, you know, 2017, 2018, it got to, hey guys, here's this report, it's coming out tomorrow. Here are the 5 points we think are interesting. Let me know if you want to talk about it. And then 7 a.m. the next day, when the embargo lifts, you got your in like Engadget, Variety, Time magazine.
Yeah, I remember it was a 2011 report maybe, where CBC, BBC, CNN, we were simultaneously the front page of all of them. Ars Technica, the /dot.
That's probably about the time Reed Hastings came for lunch.
Like, it was, not many people know that when Reed Hastings came to Waterloo.
Yeah.
And that was like, that was a pretty neat moment. And the funny thing is, I mean, we could do an entire podcast just about this and how that study came about. But the main story was the Netflix thing, which in preparing the study, I had thought it was just another little piece of trivia, but then through the embargo, I think it was like GigaOhm or someone had asked.
Yeah,
there were two of them had come back and said, that Netflix point, you know, it was literally one bullet that said, oh, Netflix is 20.6% of traffic. that Netflix point is pretty interesting. Could you get us some more data? And we're sure. We were happy to. We turned it around an hour or something, got them a bunch more data about that particular data point, and that became the lead story for everything. So I'd miss it in preparing the report, but in listening to the audiences and in getting them what they needed to be successful, like they were close enough ears to the ground to know what was going to be very important and what was going to generate attention or clicks, whatever metrics they were going after there, and we just helped them be successful. And another thing I guess to point out is this was over quite a long haul. You know, this wasn't a single year program where we did something and it was amazing. It was for a few years now, Sandvine had been doing press releases about interesting internet stats.
Started in 2008, I want to say.
Yeah, and it was like Skype traffic spiked on New
Year's
Day.
First one was gaming, bit 40%.
Call of Duty.
First one they ever got was like 40% of internet traffic was peer-to-peer.
Yeah.
Because was it torrent? No, it wasn't. It was peer-to-peer.
No, this was like...
Pre-BitTorrent, yeah, yeah.
Napster and eDonkey and Ares and Nutella.
Kazaa.
Kazaa was the first one. So there were singular data points. I guess we're going kind of all over the place, but to explain the program, what became a program, singular data points as press releases for a Canadian tech company that was trying to get attention, basically, right? The peer-to-peer thing was more specific because we were talking about a problem that no one else in the world had really recognized, and we had a really good solution to it.
Mm-hmm.
Then over time, around 2010, when the program sort of fell into my lap, that was when I started building it out more robust. I didn't want to have single data points. I didn't want to have things that were from one or two networks. I wanted a much larger data foundation that would stand up, because the more we got attention, the more our competitors were going to come gunning for us. So it needed to stand up to scrutiny. And that's where the engineer background in me built out that data foundation and the year-over-year traffic comparisons. Because we went from snapshots to trends. And that was the 2010. And the annoying thing was, so I built out this data infrastructure, but I knew the payoff was going to be a year or two down the line, because you can't do a trend with one data point. Even the second data point, you're like, you don't know. There could just be ebbs and flows. Once we got those third and fourth ones in, you know, looking every 6 months or every year, we could reliably say how fast was traffic growing, how were different categories and different applications changing over time. And that was when we caught the lightning in a bottle with the Netflix stat. And that was, you know, that was the wind in our sails. And then over time, and this was the same time that you came in and took over the program, and where I think you really took it to the next level was on the communication side, right? Having those relationships, understanding how the media worked, what they were looking for, being attentive to their needs over time, to the point where it completely flipped around and they were reaching out to you ahead of time and go, hey, when's your next study coming out?
Mm-hmm.
Or, hey, I just saw this news this news about Netflix or Amazon or you know, Microsoft releasing a new game console. What do you guys have to say on that? And we were being asked to comment on stories that we weren't even a part of.
Yeah.
It didn't happen overnight. And that's a challenge, I think, for startups who want to, they want to achieve that level of success, but they want to do it in 6 months or a year.
Behind the curtain, that first study, which was 2008, which was 4 years before I got there, was one data point from one customer. Because at the time, Sandvine had been around for 5 or 6, 7 years, I guess, at that point, but still didn't quite have a...
We were subject to which customers would let us.
But also, I think at that point, products had changed, it evolved, right? Like any new, pivot. And I think at that point I can't remember the name of the product because I wasn't around. It was like a peer-to-peer thing.
The PPE.
It was basically designed to help Kazaa and other services work, right?
It would keep them working while serving traffic from a local
network. Yeah, so it would keep it within, so not have it come over the top, right?
Yeah, so it wouldn't cross the network boundaries where you would have to pay transit costs.
Yeah, and that data did come from one customer in Canada. But like that's interesting. And so that was a little bit of success. And then as you built up the program, it got into probably dozens. And by the end, we were pushing data from 100 customers. millions of subscribers, right? And it took a long time. And what really got interesting was the trends. You're right, the trends year over year, right? Netflix was interesting. What really got where the rubber met the road was, like, for the longest time, we talked a lot. It was originally a report also designed for engineers, because that's the people that were buying our products. So, you know, and network engineers they're the people sales would interact with, and we'd come out with charts and say, well, here's peak period, and here's the traffic growth here, and here's different categories of traffic, and no one really, not that no one related to that, the engineers certainly did. They're interested in engineering their network for quality and minimizing latency and making sure video streaming works and things like that.
I remember the first crack I took at a longer report, so it was like 20 pages or something, rather than a press release. Had a bunch of peak to trough ratios.
Oh yeah, just stupid charts. Like not stupid charts, but like
the Cable Labs folks.
Oh,
loved.
Yeah,
but was very hard for the general public to understand.
Just, and then we eventually dropped those over time because no one cared peak versus non-peak. Not that no one cared. It just we quickly realized that
the audiences that were carrying the story didn't care
so much,
and the people who did care would reach out to us individually.
So you'd get called from the CTO of a cable co in the US and be like, explain this to me, and you'd be like, I don't know, I'm not the guy, and you'd pull in our CTO or whoever to do it, right? But where though we had success was then you started talking to, well, what are the things that people are interested in, what's consuming people's time? And that's where Netflix took off. It's like, oh, okay, well, this is really interesting, what's happening streaming video, and then that went to what's happening with streaming music, what's happening with peer-to-peer. How is our culture changing? How is consumption changing? And then how is that being reflected in the internet data? And you're quickly seeing, okay, well, all of a sudden Netflix is a huge amount of traffic and BitTorrent is going down. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you know, what were the stories? Periscope and Meerkat would come out, which were these flash in the pan category of apps that were, oh, you're going to live stream. You're going to live stream your life. What's the impact of these? And you quickly go, it's nothing, right? Yeah. Like no one was using them. Everyone was writing about them, but no one was using them.
And we were constantly butting up against Cisco, who predicted that in 2 years, video was going to be 95%
But Cisco, the challenge, you know, we did have people who were writing competing reports, but Cisco, the fault Cisco had was they were writing about categories. Now they're writing at a global level, talking to big telcos interested in doing different stuff, but where people were able to see our data and consume the data was talking and interesting things that were relatable. Mm-hmm. Like, I see this in my daily life. I use Netflix.
Use Spotify. We added commentary, whereas Cisco's was more academic.
Yeah, and I think there's absolute merits to both, right? Like we had as a scrappier upstart, which, I mean,
a sort of Canadian Cisco.
A sort of Canadian Cisco, once referred to as Gizmodo. You know, a scrappy upstart that, you know, had at the end of it, you know, $100+ million of revenue isn't so much of a scrappy upstart, but compared to Cisco or Ericsson, you're a scrappy upstart. Like, how do you differentiate yourself? And so, you know, there's a lot of companies in Waterloo region that have some really interesting data and could probably start with some of that stuff. Like,
yeah,
you know, I always remember thinking about talking to Taco at MyoVision about stuff they have. And it's like, you know, just how you see stories about old cranks complaining about intersections opening up and crosswalks. And what do you have that type of data where you could go talk to them and, you know, have and just be sharing, well, this is what happens when a four-way stop opens up. And what's it mean, right? Do you have the data? Is a very big challenge. But if you have the data, can you publish in a way that's relatable and that people understand, that reporters will understand, that you know, Joe newspaper reader who's probably someone in their mid-50s can understand, and, you know, it's going to share that anecdote, and eventually maybe they become a buyer, because that's where we saw success, right? At the end of the day, we were trying to sell to large telcos. The lead generation process was, you know, it's not as easy as a software as a service, you know, come buy it, press a button and install it.
Add to cart,
right? We were saying, okay, there's 500 companies in the world we want to sell to. How do we get their interest?
Yeah.
And we were talking to
get
network.
Their recognition.
How do we get their network engineers?
Yeah.
But all of a sudden you write an article and it's in Engadget, Ars Technica, wherever, the Toronto Star, CNN, then all of a sudden we're getting calls from SVPs and C-levels. What's my Netflix number?
Well, are they What's recognize... my Toronto number? Yeah, they would reach out to us. I always found this really interesting. They run networks, and they would reach out to us to tell them about their network. Like, there were times as well where, I remember the Netflix thing, they rolled out, I mean, it's ubiquitous now, or nearly ubiquitous now, but they rolled out country by country. yeah. or region by region, and we would get calls and we would go in. I remember going on these road trips to talk to people about Netflix is coming to your country in 8 months. Here's what's going to happen to your network.
Yeah. Because we had the Canadian data at that time, right?
We'd had the U.S., then we saw how they expanded in Canada, and then it was Latin America, I think, before they went to Europe.
It was a rights thing for the most part. Yeah, it was Latin America first.
Yeah, they have to work out all their deals, all those Latin American soaps. So going into Europe, I remember doing a roadshow there for a couple of weeks, and part of the attraction was, hey, this guy's going to come and tell you what your network is going to look like next year. And I'm saying, hey, Netflix is zero of your network now, 0.02% or something, because people are tunneling it right now. Next year, it's going to be like 12% of your network. And that's going to be net new addition. That isn't, it's not cannibalizing. Some of the peer-to-peer would go down, but on the whole, the streaming was going to be an increase. And every country, I remember those meetings, every country and every operator listened. Although there was one meeting in Germany where the room was just, like, they will never succeed here. Our tastes are very different. They won't. I'm like, they're going to invest in local content and all this stuff. And that room, it was just weird. I had 20 meetings over 2 weeks or something in like 12 different countries. And every single one understood and was appreciative and was a little bit alarmed and would have to figure out their strategy. And then this one room is just like, nope, not going to happen here. And I remember looking at the stats later and being like, it's happening there.
The amount of executives that we dealt with, and this is like senior, SVP, C-level, that we have conversations with over the time that run telcos, the lack of information they have is somewhat kind of shocking. Now, obviously, we are trying to sell to some of them.
They're nine layers away from the people who look at
it. Yeah, and so the people who use your product either don't have the clout or don't have the foresight, or it just doesn't funnel up.
They often are very much against people seeing the data, because then, if they find out I can get them this data, they're going to be wanting to ask questions and I'm going to have to get them. And that was always interesting from a marketing standpoint, because one of our strategies was to increase the breadth of things. You want to increase share of wallet, get more money out of a customer. But from a competitive standpoint, to fight off the niche players, or we're not only network operations and peer-to-peer management, we're also a business intelligence solution. Mm-hmm. And the engineers and ops people would say, don't you dare tell the marketing people they can get this information.
Yeah.
Because that will make my life slightly more complicated.
I'll have to run more reports.
Yeah. And then you're like, how do we fit that into our strategy of, how do you manage the politics there of trying to sell more into an account while risking alienating the person who's using your product?
Yeah.
But one thing that came out of the mainstream success, because a lot of, it's funny, I think a lot of companies chase the headlines thinking that's going to solve all their problems, but it doesn't. Like, attention doesn't turn into sales very directly. In our case, it was slightly different. There was a closer relationship, because the people who ultimately were signing the check would recognize the Sandvine name from something they read in, like you said, Variety or Wall Street Journal or New York Times. They'd be like, we're handing money to that company. I've heard of them. They're widely regarded in the space. And it would grease those wheels a little bit. Or at a trade show, people would come up and, what do you guys do? And, being familiar with the stat that Netflix is a third of internet traffic? Oh, yeah, everyone's familiar with that. Like, well, that was us.
Yeah.
I was at a TM forum in, I think it was either Nice or in Dublin, and the keynote was a guy from Ericsson, and one of his opening slide was, Netflix is a third of internet traffic. And I'm sitting in this auditorium of like 2,000 people, and I'm like, give credit to the source. It was me.
Well, and potentially, I saw some of the data, post merger, acquisition, whatever, merge acquisition of the two companies, right? And the feedback was, when they merged the two companies together, Procera and Sandvine, what was the rationale for keeping the name for what it is? And one of the things that the brand recognition thing came back to, more people recognize the Sandvine brand.
Yeah.
And so was that due to us? Was it, I like to think that small part of that was due to us, because they had seen the stats and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, that was always interesting, right? And to see the data with some markets, like, they put a significant amount of market research to discover that, to make a decision about how to build that business going forward. It's kind of cool to say, I helped steer that ship with, a bunch of other people, like the Rick doing investors and Dave doing all this stuff and all those things. But
the private equity group had done a market analysis, mm-hmm. and found that our brand was
much, it was like 8-1 or something, much more highly recognized and trusted. I mean, people talk about thought leadership, and it's one of these, I kind of don't like the term because it gets thrown around really haphazardly, but the Phenomena program at Sandvine was a legitimate example of thought leadership.
Thought leadership is a long game, right? Yeah. Like it's not a we're going to do one report and change the world. It's like you've got to have cadence, and you've got to do it over and over and over again, and then
and you can lose the credibility instantly.
Oh yeah,
which
we can talk about that instance.
We were paranoid about that to the point that it kept us on our toes, making sure we had the very robust data set. Yeah, we'll come to that in a sec. Cause there's one other thing that I was just reminded of. The Phenomena program wasn't our only thought leadership program, right? It was a very visible one. It was an incredibly cost-effective one because it was basically...
less cost-effective because I knew what they paid me to make it.
And I did everything initially on evenings and weekends secretly. But we also had the technical marketing, the white papers as well, which would help people understand more challenges. So it was a multi-pronged approach. And what's funny is looking back, we've joked about this before, right? We could tell the story of how it was very strategic and all this stuff, but it evolved quite organically in response to, it was much more lean and agile in the sense that we got feedback from our audiences and tweaked the program over time.
Oh yeah. Like this, like an example would be the stuff we did at the end, which, I mean, if I look back now and say my biggest career, like a thing I wish I had had the opportunity to turn into more, and probably the change in ownership at Sandvine caused me not to be interested so much anymore, was like when we got into like Kodi and we got into pirated television and all this stuff that we were the first to that. I went on so many speaking trips for like that final year, just like telling people about, like, initially we started doing some research around Kodi. So Kodi at the time, you know, you could see there were signs at the corner of Columbia and King. It was like, buy a Kodi box. And people would be like, what is this? And you could buy pirated television. And we got a couple questions from, you know, customers, and we dug into it, and we said, oh crap, 10% of people have them. And then, okay, well, that's interesting, but what's it actually costing operators?
Well, and even backing up there for a sec, people had heard of it, but no one knew the prevalence.
Yeah, no,
this was sold, and people have been building their own, and for a couple of years now, and then we actually measured it.
Yes, and so one of the things is not all people knew about it because, when a surprise, when you work for a telco, you get your services either free or discounted. Yeah. So like a lot of people didn't see the need for them. When you're dealing with senior executives, they certainly have the ability to afford their own television.
Yeah.
So the idea that people were just...
Until Johnny Old CEO's grandson mentions it.
Right, yeah. So we got into that. And then, you know, the idea of getting into... So that came out of a request, and it came out of some hacked together code, some scripts. Mm-hmm. And then the report came out in like 2 weeks.
Yeah, Brent was at a customer conference.
Yeah, pretty quickly. And then
that was what they wanted to
hear. And then that evolved into doing, you know, we're hopping over all over the place a little bit here, but that then turned into doing some research into paid IPTV or paid streaming services, where people pay $10 a month to basically bootleg, like it's basically paying for Rogers or Bell Cable or Satellite.
So we were listening, in marketing parlance, we were listening to our customer base, identifying to hear the problems that they had. And then we were helping them to better understand those problems while at the same time determining what we could do to help solve.
And I think the pivot, the IPTV stuff that came later, was actually Johnny C, a sales engineer in Canada, was like, have you guys seen this? And like he got told by someone about it, and inside a customer, and we built
it,
this stuff.
It went from crappy quality, maybe crappy quality streams, to for like $10 a month you get
2,000 channels,
2,000
right?
IPTV
channels. That wasn't like an evolution of the thought leadership that we were able to do. So we had done programmatically twice a year. Thanks Dave Caputo for saying we do it twice a year. Our CEO at one point committed us to doing the report twice a year, which was actually became a challenge because early on the internet changed. I mean, back in 2012, it was changing a lot.
The magnitude of the changes became incremental.
Incremental, right? Yeah. And so we eventually pivoted to going back to one report a year, because the changes were then more substantial. But then these little technical reports. So, you know, we said, okay, we've got this main report, we can do year-over-year trending, but we're still going to do these pieces that we think are interesting, pieces that we think are important to our business. And what we're able to do then is really drill down on issues that we think could address opening that share of wallet, where we got into, we think there might be a market for detecting pirated television, and how can we get involved in that? Well, here's a report on it. Here's a technical white paper on the ecosystem and behind the scenes.
Those evolved quite quickly too, because we were publishing as quickly as we were learning.
Yeah, and so like things around data fraud and VoIP fraud and Viber and all these types of things, we were publishing real quick because we got into got to learn that, you know, we could put together 8 pages of stuff really quickly because charts take up a lot of space on a page. Well, and a very simple explanation.
These are problems. The phenomena, the general phenomena stuff, consumer internet trends. Interesting. Long-term planning, sure, they have some impact. Largely trivia. I don't mean that to denigrate the reports.
Oh, like I view it as trivia.
There was
like
a lot of value there. Yeah, and they were interesting. They were great conversation starters. But these latter reports, IPTV fraud, voice fraud, SIM card stuff, these immediately landed on executive desks because they were quantifying and explaining things that were eating into revenue.
Yeah.
People are cord cutting, or our voice minutes are down, or our international calls have plummeted. All of a sudden, a revenue stream is getting turned off. Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they were fun, and we were able to get media coverage for them, less so than, hey, we're talking about Netflix. It's like, hey, we're talking about
more niche
data fraud. But the people that were interested in that stuff were the people we had good relationships with. So like Ars Technica, who's like a publication, whenever we did the report, they were my favorite to deal with because they always asked questions.
Their questions made the reports better.
Yeah. So I remember it got to the point in 2017, 2016, we would just send the report and it would just show up. And it was like, that's really easy. But Ars Technica would always come back. John Brogdon is like the smart, just one of the best reporters I've worked with, because he just asks questions. He's tough on everyone he deals with. Vendors, tough on telcos, tough on anyone. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the questions he came back was like, why is Netflix number one or number two in the upstream? And you're like, that's a great question. We don't even talk about it in the report, but that's interesting. And you're like, why is it? And you go, it's
TCP
ACK packet. So the way the internet works is, you know, Netflix sends you something, and then you've got to send something back to Netflix that says, I got it, send the next piece of video. Yeah. Oh. And so when Netflix is 30, 35, 40% of traffic on the downstream, the number one source of upstream traffic,
you've got 40 megabit of Netflix coming down.
Quickly becomes Netflix, because no one uses the concept of upstream internet is a thing that doesn't really exist anymore. Upload your photos, you upload your phone backup at night. No one's, you know, meerkatting or periscoping, unfortunately, right? So like there's not a lot of upstream traffic, so Netflix dominates. So like those are the types of things.
Writing about ACK starvation.
Yeah, ACK starvation. It's going to be a thing.
I learned a lot about TCP over the years.
Yeah, right. those are the things. So that's what I kind of liked to appreciate how the report evolved. And from a personal career standpoint, I got bored with the reports at the end because nothing was changing. It was like, okay, I'll do the same charts and try to come up with new commentary. But guess what? Netflix is number one. YouTube's number two.
Yeah.
And then it got into actually one of the challenges we wanted to get into it became a stakeholder management challenge where, you know, we alluded to that Reed Hastings came down for lunch.
Yeah.
Right in 2014
we'll save that for the end to keep people listening.
Okay. But it got into a stakeholder management program where eventually we started writing this report, you know, Netflix's, Amazon's, YouTube, Google's would call and yell at us or complain about us or ask us when something's coming. So you're trying to all of a sudden manage people and say, okay, well, our data shows that Amazon grew at X. And Amazon will come to you and say, well, we grew at Y. And you'd be like, well, maybe it's within the error bars, but you know, you're trying to manage the data in your report that's accurate, put a message out to the market that's accurate, knowing that the companies that you're talking about, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, they all have PR teams and relationships with the reporters that you're dealing with that are just better or larger, or they have more firepower to you. So if you come out and say, well, actually, Amazon shrunk, and Amazon says, haha, here's our network data, we've grown by 300%.
Yeah.
You're going to have egg on your face pretty quickly. And we saw that with a competitor, right? Like,
yeah, we did. So let's loop back to that in a minute.
Sure.
And here's what I'm thinking as well, is we'll touch on a couple more topics and then try to stitch it together at the end for any companies that are thinking of, or maybe aren't even thinking of, data-driven PR and media stuff. So when you mentioned stakeholders, where my mind first went was the internal stakeholders.
Yeah.
So when I first started writing the longer form reports, we still reported up into head of sales and marketing. And the sales was like in all caps and the marketing was, you know, maybe, you know, dot, dot, dot. So I wrote this report and I was looking at it as objective as possible exposition of what's happening on the internet in terms of consumer trends. Aren't all these things neat? Look at the data. Isn't it interesting? I'll talk about what I think the data means and where I think it's going to go, that sort of thing. And then there was constant internal pressure to add in a whole bunch of sales pitches.
Oh, yeah.
It's got to be, it can't just be this analysis. You have to throw in that our product solves a problem and you have to talk about this technology. And it was funny because I was, when was this? This was 2010, I think, when I first started doing the longer form ones. And I was in like my mid-late 20s. I'd been at the company for a few years, so I had some, you know, reasonable reputation. But I'm still sitting in a room with people where their title starts with C, and it's three letters long. So it's essentially an opinion fight. It's, you need to put this stuff in, and I'm saying, I don't think we do. I think that will compromise our status here. And I'm thinking long game, all the same things we've talked about. What are people interested in? What are readers interested in? You're not interested in reading a sales pitch. You're interested in learning. And I knew, or I suspected, my instinct was such that that would be of benefit to us over time. But the moment you start putting in centerfolds of product pitches and things, you're going to lose them. So the internal stakeholders, there was the sales pitch side, which I think I managed to resist quite a bit. Where we would try to accommodate was if we were doing a technical feature on something like an explanation as to why some particular
act starvation,
right? Things where we can bring unique intelligence or unique insight to the table, and it would tie in possibly to a product or a feature, but it wouldn't be a pitch. It would be more of a feature explanation. Here's why you need this thing in your solution. Otherwise, you're not going to see this when it's happening on your own network. And then there was the funny aspect as well of trying to manage the hopes and dreams of what we could possibly put in it someday, which were technically impossible. So someone would get excited internally. Oh, we should do this. Oh, that's amazing. Ah, I'm like, we literally cannot do that. And again, I'm this mid-20s person in marketing trying to explain to, you know, an exec that I know that would be neat. It would be neat to be able to track or approximate the number of eyeballs on blah, blah, blah on different screens, but we can't. Maybe someday we can, but right now we can't. So managing those internal expectations to keep the vision of the program as nascent as it was, to keep the vision true. And I think over time it was validated that was the right approach. Now back to the point you're talking about. So we mentioned again a little bit earlier that we set out to make a very robust data platform because I think we just knew someday, you know, we had competitors. We weren't the only ones trying to write about stats. There was going to be some mudslinging at some point, and I wanted a bulletproof, just, hey, this is the data. Here's how we were very transparent about how we aggregated it, how we normalized things, and how we brought it all together to be a representative sample. There were times where we didn't publish for regions where we didn't get enough data. We just said, nope, can't count on that, because we didn't want to compromise our reliability and the trustworthiness of our information. And then as you were saying, I don't know, do you want to tell the story about the...
Well, it's not like, it was early in days. So like there was like, so talking about, I was always like, the thing that would stress me out would be like publishing a wrong number or someone calling me out and being like, Netflix, Amazon, whoever, being like, no, you're wrong. Yeah. Here's our data. They lay their table cards on the table and they go, they know.
Because they noticed the studies immediately.
Netflix did early on, right? And because they were the lead stat always. And then they actually got very symbiotic in the sense of like, we would give them an advanced copy of the report to say like, hey, does this jive with what you're seeing? And we did the same for Google and did the same for Amazon, because it was more about like, before we go to the media with this, like, is there anything that's off? And they'd come back with feedback sometimes, yeah. And sometimes it'd be very, they'd try to editorialize and we just would cut that out.
I remember Microsoft reached out to us ahead of time around one of the Xbox launches.
Yeah, Microsoft used peer-to-peer to
Teredo. They changed the protocol for gaming, and they wanted to make sure that it was accurately captured.
All these things, right? So that was pretty cool. But I was always paranoid about just, you know, we put a wrong number, someone says this, and then you're
cautiously
screwed. Aware. Well, you're screwed then, right? Yeah. And when you have ownership of it. I know it was the 2012 Olympics, 2014 Olympics. We were competing against
the London Olympics.
So we did stuff, and a competitor put out like stats that said like, "Oh, Netflix experienced a drop during the Summer Olympics. You know, everyone was watching the Olympics instead of Netflix." And then Netflix basically like, "Well, actually," them the next day was like, "Well, actually, no, we didn't see a drop. Here's our charts. Here's how it went." And at the time, the two companies were competing for a very, very large.
Well, you know why Netflix did that.
Why would it,
they lost hundreds of millions of dollars in market cap.
And share value, because people were like, "Oh, people are still going to watch live TV."
Clearly, Netflix isn't as important as everyone talked about.
Yes, and to a certain extent, our reports for the first few years
they had always
ebbed and flowed the value of Netflix's stock, which is one of the reasons why I think save it to the end. We had lunch 3 days. It's very it's a very uninspired story, but I mean, we'll come back to it.
Yeah, so they had lost a ton of market cap, and so they'd followed these reports for a while, and then this opened their eyes to the potential of real impact to them from an externality, some other company commenting on them. Because there was a lot of attention around Netflix in the finance community about how many subscribers were they adding, how much were people watching. So absent that insider data, they were using the internet trends and traffic as kind of a proxy for Netflix's popularity and staying power.
Yeah.
So this competitor puts out a report. They cherry-picked a stat, and cherry-picked a sensational one that Netflix had dropped substantially. Published this stat, Netflix's market cap dropped, and they realized they needed to look into it.
Yeah, and they came out the next day and said, "Well, actually, no, we didn't. Here's our chart." For us at the time, we were in a competitive environment.
Well, they literally said, "Perhaps vendor X's equipment is unable to accurately..."
Like the quote was basically awesome. We were in final... A large company was in final decision-making about us or the competitor.
Yeah.
Our sales guys like ran as fast as they could with like this quote. We eventually won the deal, which was tens of millions of dollars at the time.
Who do you want to buy?
Over the life of the contract, right?
Who do you want to buy? The company whose data has always stood up to scrutiny, or these ones that just got called out in the media for not being able to identify the top source of traffic on your
and
network?
The output of that was we also became a staple in the Netflix shareholder letter. For about 5 years, our charts were like, one, they took our charts and then remade them to be better, which, I mean, our charts could have always looked better because they were straight out of Excel. But then they put them in the investor letter because they would always do investor letter, and they would say, "Well, here's our subscriber growth, and then that matches with internet trend growth," or they'd have some narrative around that, right? Like, because there were some times where Netflix bandwidth went down, but that was because Netflix actually got better they got better at encoding their video. They got more intelligent about, rather than encode all video the same way, they decided, "Well, we can encode animation one way, action movies a different
action
way.
Action movies,
and it'll save us bandwidth, it'll save operators bandwidth." They talked to us about it, educated us on
technology.
It. So we were able to talk about it in the report. So we weren't just like, "Netflix drops 5%.
Well, yep.
What does that mean?" Well, it's actually they got better, so everyone should strive to do this.
Yeah. So the very anticlimactic climax of this particular story and a career highlight for Mr. Dan Deeth was shortly after all of this came to light through the media, Reed Hastings and Bill Holmes.
Bill Holmes. He's Canadian. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So they reached out and they wanted to come, and they did come up to the Sandvine offices in Waterloo specifically to meet with, basically to understand how the project, how the Phenomena data came together, because they were saying, if we're going to point to you as a reliable source, we need to know that you're a reliable
source.
There
is one step in the story that we have not, that I'm just recalling back. I went to at the cable show in 2011 or 2012, 2013, somewhere in there.
One of the
20s. We released a press release that said Netflix has peaked.
Yeah.
And they did not like that.
Oh, yeah.
And Bill Holmes came up to me, who I'm like 8 months into my job or a year into my job, being like, it's like, "I'm Bill Holmes, like senior VP of," is like, "We should have a chat."
Yeah.
"Is your CTO here?" Because I believe Don was the person quoted in
the
press release.
He wants to be provocative.
Yes, he did.
It was all about being provocative in a press release.
And so they're like, "We should talk." And then that's when they invited themselves down. So it was like an in-person invite is what it was. And they basically told us, "We're coming down to Waterloo."
Yeah.
And I assumed they're like, "Oh, you're coming down." At the time, BlackBerry, one of the stories, the narrative is like, I think BlackBerry 10 had just come out or the playbook had just come out, and sort of like Netflix isn't supporting the playbook. And I was like, you guys are going to come down, you're going to hash it out, you're going to figure out, and you're just going to like scoot over and see little old Sandvine. And so they were in Toronto for the TIFF festival in September. That's what they came down for. And they like came down for the day just to see us, just to like,
yeah, it was
talk us through what you're about and let me understand how it is. And it was Reed and Bill,
Dave, Don, you and me.
Yeah. And a platter of quick sandwiches.
It wasn't quick sandwich. I think I would have felt good if it was quick sandwich.
If it was really bad catered sandwich. I was aghast.
Quick sandwich. No, they know their sandwiches.
I don't think we ate it. No, Reed did eat. I remember Reed eating and being, oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah. But anyways, and they talked through and it was very interesting to watch. Like Reed's a genius. Like not in the sense of like, sure, smart business dude, but also like, and from an engineering standpoint, he's an engineer by trade, yeah. I think, right? And he just knew it inside. Now, it took him about 5 minutes of us talking to be like, okay, I get it.
To be fair, it's not a complex project. It's
No. It's really simple.
A balanced aggregation of numbers, and it's entirely dependent on sample size and the lack of bias in a sample.
Yes.
Once he understood that that was how, that we were, I guess, one of those themes in this conversation, that we were being authentic with how we produced the study, and we weren't cherry picking, he was fine.
Yeah.
His concerns were addressed.
Yeah.
But it's certainly having, if not an ally like Netflix, having them not be an enemy was of value to us.
Yeah. And it was an interesting relationship over time. Like we had, while we were frenemies, right, at one point, like we don't talk a lot about, like, we got a lot of success after talking about Netflix, and Netflix benefited a lot from their messaging by pointing to us and saying, here's a trusted third party. But then there was also a time when we talked about other times of thought leadership where we basically called Netflix, you know, a lying cheat. Or I don't know what I would consider, right? Because we wrote a report Netflix was a big, eventually became a big juggernaut, and they were, the way that they would send traffic, they were sending traffic to certain internet service providers
allegedly,
as they would say, in a manner that put undue cost upon the network operator when they could have chosen a different way.
It's a nice network you got there, right? It'd be a shame if it suddenly cost more money.
And they were mad at us, and we were just like trying to show data. We were trying to support our customers.
I was just the poor guy writing the report.
You were the guy writing the report, and I was doing the PR for it. And Don was getting into yelling matches at Nanog with them, right? But not yelling. Awesome. Don wasn't yelling. Let's be very clear. Don was like super cool. Don was super cool all the time. But that person who ran network operations for Netflix was yelling at Don, and Don was just
that was amazing.
Don was being very cool.
Right.
So yeah, Don was just being cool and working with data.
I don't always watch screens.
But yeah, so the point is the relationship was interesting, and so it was symbiotic for a little bit, and we also used that, but we're also able to use that knowledge and experience and reputation we had in the industry to talk badly about them. And when we were able to talk badly about them, people believed it. Not that we talked badly about them, we were presenting data that they didn't necessarily like.
Yeah, that was the
and we laid our
undercurrent here.
We laid our cards on the table and said, here's the data.
Yeah.
And to your point, it wasn't a sales pitch. We had no interest in selling stuff. It was more about we were the only people with the data who could gather it from a bunch of sources and say, here's what we think is happening.
It was literally front page news.
Yes. Right? That was like my prouder point of that is that was Wall Street Journal news. Like that's like
Comcast and Netflix were waging a very
it's fun to be like it's cool to be in Gadget and those places. And those are great publications and tier one. But like Wall Street Journal was like that's like the pinnacle. I've got a copy of it somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's like, we were on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and it was not a story. It was a story we pitched and a story that they took, and with some help from our cable company friends. But like, that was cool, because it was like, that's legit business journalism.
Yeah, and why does it matter versus our competitors, both peer and niche, and even our large, the Huawei's and Cisco's and Ericsson's of the world, of all of the possible sources of information to shed light on this very complex subject, it was this relatively little company from Canada who was. And that gave us, you're not going to win a deal exactly for that reason alone, but a lot of factors go into who gets the purchase order. And being the trusted source of information about the internet, and being trusted that you can in our case, recognize the traffic correctly to ultimately do something with it was very important.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite thing is that at the end of the day, we were like where people still at the, you know, there are certain people in the corners of the internet who you love to yell net neutrality and all these things at us as a company. At the end of the day, I think we did a very good job of balancing just being a trusted advisor, putting cards on the table, being easy to work with. And that went from with like Netflix loved us and hated us that sometimes like media loved us or hate, like they didn't love us, but they like, they found us easy to work with and kept coming back to us for comment. And our operator partners would come to us and sometimes we'd publish data they liked and sometimes they would publish data they didn't like, but it was the data.
Yeah.
And just building that out over time, I think was good for the company. The one thing I regret, and I wish we could have, and I think this was maybe a systemic problem we had at the company, and there was no way to measure the value we provided. Mm-hmm. It was very like nebulous about like, well, what value does the phenomena program provide? Yeah. So you're paying me half 0.5 headcount to do this program, 0.3 headcount or whatever it would take up my time. What's the value it's providing? And not in the terms of like, oh, am I worth my salary? You should pay me more. It was more of a, how many leads am I helping?
In today's world of how many leads am I helping to close? Marketing metrics.
Yeah.
It would be a very hard program to justify because the numbers that came in were like, I remember looking at the form fills for the downloads and these were audiences and seniority levels and departments that we would not have conversations with otherwise.
Yeah.
And we'd get thousands of these downloads.
Yeah. Each report would get in the first month, 2000
downloads. And like important people who we don't normally access. Yet we wouldn't do anything with them.
Yes, that was the most frustrating thing. And so that's like where I look at a company like us. We, eCenter here. I marvel at the lead gen process and the fun. Like I just like this is a well-oiled machine in terms of the people running the show on that regard.
Yeah.
Just know their stuff and they're great at it. And we're getting better as a communications department figuring out how we tuck in and how to feed into that and demonstrate value. And we're way better than we were at Samine. Yeah. But
our salespeople didn't want anything to do with the leads. We'd be like, I really think you need to talk to this person.
And so I think, you know, there was missed opportunity to be like, why aren't people talking to some of these telecom? Yeah. Like, there's so many people they could have talked to. And we never did much with the data. Like, I remember just requesting the spreadsheet. I'm like, what are we doing with this? And I used to have to highlight manually, all right, here's the APAC guys you probably want to talk to. And I would just send it. It felt like it was going into the ether.
Yeah.
And it's a different, I mean, our sales cycle is very different than the SaaS cycle that's very common here.
Yeah,
the volume is lower, it's higher touch, it's more technical. There's all these challenges.
Our salespeople felt they didn't need those contacts because they already had.
I know a guy who knows a guy. But you're like, well, this guy sits in the fraud prevention department.
This guy's desk.
This guy sits in the legal department. Yeah. You don't think you'd want to, like, why would you not want to talk to the head of legal? Yeah. Because they probably got budget
in a
way that you don't understand.
And, right? That's a good point. There was like the fraud stuff, there was immediate budget. It was an acute, urgent problem that they wanted to solve.
Yes.
And so they would find money to solve it.
Which we didn't really have a solution to the problem. We could shine a light on the problem.
We could help them understand.
The problem, right? There was no solution to that problem.
So I think to try to pull, as promised, to try to pull some of the threads together here to weave a rich tapestry of data-driven thought leadership, since that seems to have emerged as the main topic here. There were a few things, I guess I can jump into the few and if you want to as well. There's a lot of companies are sitting on a lot of data and they don't realize the value of it. And so I guess you'd have to ask yourself, are there people who potentially are interested in this? In its aggregate, anonymous form, you know, privacy and security, you know, would address all those concerns. And a second thing is, it's easier today, I think, than it was certainly for us. It was very hard for us to get the data because our system wasn't built to automatically send data back. And we would have to ask and negotiate with each of our customers individually to even pull back aggregate data. And that slowed the process down.
Yeah, we had to use Smurfs. Did you ever watch Breaking Bad?
No.
Okay, so like I believe the term was Smurfs, right? It's like, so they used to, when they're trying to cook meth, they'd send Smurfs, and Smurfs were like these guys who would go to different drugstores and buy the Sudafed and then collect it all and bring it back. And that's what we had to employ. We had to employ Smurfs to like go customer to customer, yeah. Manually run something, wait 2 hours, collect it, yeah. FTP it back. It
was our just sales engineers to essentially beg customers to.
It was a process that was unbearable, was not sustainable. We didn't like the lock in we had on terms of what people committing. Like sometimes they'd commit, sometimes they'd uncommit. How did that work? There was no systemic way to get the data back, right?
So you want to have a data archive. You want to have easy access to the data archive. You want to ask yourself, what are the questions that people outside the building are interested in? And they could be customers, or they could be media or some other third party. I've been fortunate enough to work with a handful of clients since starting Cromulent. And
I thought you were against putting sales pitches inside your content.
This isn't a sales
pitch. Oh, okay.
a hard time. It's more missed opportunity, I think. At least a quarter, maybe half, have really interesting stats coming back from their systems that I think could be leveraged into a program. And another thing is people think these programs are massively, these huge investments, and they're not, right? They can be if they're ongoing, but even then it's more of a little touch here and there. The Phenomena program we did was outside looking in, huge, and in terms of impact to the company, very significant, mm-hmm. if not in a quantitative sense and in a qualitative sense. But it was essentially a bit of time for me, then a bit of time for you, and a really scattered bits of time amongst our sales engineers to actually get that data in. But it's asymmetric in the sense that the time we put in, the value we got out was vastly, vastly higher. And I see that as the opportunity for a lot of the companies I work with. And I notice, I understand that they're working with competing priorities. There's too much to do. How do you carve out the time to do it? And for a long-term thing, it's like the old adage, the best time to plant a tree was like 20 years ago. The value of a thought leadership program is truly going to increase over time. You want to have started it as early as you can, because then you can at least point back to that, and you can build and you can evolve it. So that's something I think people are missing, that opportunity. And it's just a little bit of dabbling, right?
It's not hard to collect, right? It's like, if you think, again, the genesis of the success Handmade had, it was one stat from one network. Mm-hmm. And it grew into, and then you kind of tasted the success.
Start somewhere, and then the adjacent starts going possible. There, right?
The one thing, you know, I think MyoVision has some cool data, just because I think a lot about like the LRT opening up and reading about access, like just the stuff. I'm like, I don't know if they have access to that data, but like that's the stuff where you can interject and say, we've got a step.
When your problem domain is poorly understood by any collection of stakeholders, it doesn't have to just be customers. It could be the analyst community. It could be media. It could be investors for the opportunity size of your market. You can bring data to that conversation, and the opinions start to fall away, and they get replaced with measurable fact.
Can you hitch your wagon to one thing that people are looking for data on and bring real data? My biggest thing is there's a lot, and we do a lot of surveys here because we're often asking the opinions of CIOs and CISOs and other people about what are their thoughts and do they think their data is protected, because, you know, a lot of people think their data is safe, but it's not. But not every company sees every breach, and it's hard to talk about in that way. So surveys play a key role in our thought leadership, and not to downplay them. But I'm a big believer in, if you can just bring unpartial data that says, oh, this is from our data set of 6 of the 7 largest MSOs in the world, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can't argue that, right? Yeah. Where's that data come from? Here's our data set from 1 million handheld devices around the world, or 1 million networks, homes with networking devices in them. Like, it's just data.
Yeah.
It's not, and it doesn't necessarily have any bias. Like, obviously, you can bias a data, all that, and that Simpsons quote is escaping me, right? But, like, stats can be made up by whatever. Right?
40% of people.
40% of people, right? But if you can do that, I think that's easy for people already. Because then once they understand your technology, how you collect that data, then they come back. And I think that's
what... It opens up a lot of conversations.
Yeah. And if you can think about the challenges that you're going to be asked about how's your technology work? How do you manage security and privacy? How do you do all these things? If you have answers to those and you're locked in, you got this box, you can become the source. And it goes back to, you know, can you form relationships with people? Can you be in the right place at the right time and just get luck? Like, a lot of times it's like, we've talked about this all the time. Like, our careers are somehow based around luck. Like, I went and worked at a company. Like, I was at Bruce Power. My wife and I didn't like it. I had a job offer at Sun Life. I said, I don't want to work in the insurance industry. My old boss worked at Sandvine. And she was like, let me get you a job. Yeah, it was Lisa. Got me a job at who's now at Bruce Power, ironically.
Yeah.
She's like, let me see what I can do. Within 24 hours, we were talking about the Super Bowl. Within 48 hours, at a job interview, a job offer. And then 6 months later, I'm writing about the internet, which then does all these things, right?
Yeah.
And so I was lucky enough
to... And we happen to be looking when...
So, like,
when a mail order DVD just quite,
it's just, yeah, right? Yeah. When, yeah, we're not going to ship mail order DVDs. We're going to do this anymore. And it's like, I dig that stuff. So I want to talk about it because I think it was interesting. And I think I brought a unique viewpoint as I toot my own horn, right? But like, those are the, I was lucky along the way. Mm-hmm. And to launch one of these programs and to get your hooks in, it's lucky. But at the same time, you just keep trying. Eventually, you're going
to
stick it.
It's one of these things where luck plays a role, but you have to be in a position to benefit from it.
Yeah. So I think you luck is going to play a role, but you can't be lucky without being good. The early days of it, we talked a lot about very engineering, put you to sleep stuff, yeah. Which actually probably in the cable labs community, a very good reputation. And then over the time, the years of managing the report, I got complaints from people that I want the technical wonky stuff in there.
Yeah.
And I cut it out because I was like, I don't care about it.
Yeah.
And so maybe we did a disservice to that community, and maybe there's opportunity to have gone in two paths of like, we're going to do something consumer focused and general and accessible, and we're going to do the like deep technical wonky stuff. The one thing I always appreciate, is that we invested, whether it made sense or not, in doing the deep technical wonky stuff, right? Like, I don't know how much writing about changing face of encryption or, you know, all these things helped our business, but I was glad that we were able to do them, and it just added to our aura of we're the guys that you can trust and talk to about. And that helps when you're a company of 800 people and $100 million revenue. It's easy to do side quests.
There's little doubt we emerged as the thought leadership leaders. Where I would cast doubt is whether or not we as an organization capitalized on that as much as possible.
No, and so that goes back to my point about earlier, and that my personal missed opportunity was like, man, we could have, like, from a personal career trajectory or a company trajectory, we could have owned and dominated at the end the conversation around IP television.
Yeah, and that was heating up
at a bad time where there was some transition in the company, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Did we underutilize it? I probably not from the like media output. Like, I don't know how much more cycles we could have gotten out of it, because at the same time, people only want to hear from you so often, and you want to come with new stuff, and that's part of my philosophy. But could we have leveraged that more into speaking in front of regulators and speaking in front of customers and investing more in just like, let's go speak at events and do that more? At the end, we didn't really.
Tying it into leads and having people pay attention to them.
All those things, the marketing automation, all this data collection stuff, we just really...
should operationalize that.
Yeah, and part of that was the company was born out at a time when those things didn't exist.
Yeah.
And the cost outlay wasn't necessarily... like, no one knew, no one had any experience. I think if we were all... travel back in time and know what we know now, we'd be like, we would have gotten on it a few years ago. And not that, and there's lots of people internally bang the drum to get that stuff in earlier, but you know, we fell on our face a little bit, but we're still successful. So I think we could have been more successful.
Yep.
Well, that's nice, but we're okay. We did okay. Adequate.
Well, yeah. And then you move on and you take those lessons to your next place.
Yeah. Like the one thing that's neat here to take the lessons I learned. And I, you know, a lot of like here, put things in a bow where we started, it's like a lot of threats exist in the world, but then, you know, I'm asking questions often about like, well, what happens on Christmas holidays?
Mm-hmm.
Like, just that idea, when people go home, when office workers go home, what happens to threats? Are computers left on? Do they go off? How many devices are active on the network?
Yeah.
What happens when the Women's World Cup is on and people are bootlegging it at their desks and they have to go to sketchy sites with coin mining malware in them? Do we see an uptick in detections?
Mm-hmm.
How can we take our data? How can we take our things and put it in a context that consumers can relate to?
Yeah.
So that we then become the go-to source. So I think that's the one takeaway I've had. And you
relating the data to, it's Matt Trashinsky and I used this analogy last week of the knowledge mountain, helping people climb that knowledge mountain.
Yeah.
So you've got a bunch of data, but you need to help them, prime them to be in a position to understand it.
Yeah, and that's one thing I find, that security is so, like, I struggled to, like, to wrap my head around all of it, because there's so, you got to be so in the weeds every day to stay out the evolving threats and how they work and the tactics and techniques. Mm-hmm. It's like my mind explodes.
It's amazing and frightening.
Remember? Yeah, so I have to rely on the people I know, and that's a, for me, that's the hardest, the biggest challenge I have here is, and I think what will happen is a lot of the people that are building up programs or wanting to build programs, they will often know their data so well that one of the errors people make and is everyone knows that.
Yeah.
Everyone knows the thing I know, so because I live in this, breathing this data.
It's and like, it's mundane to them.
Yeah, and so that's the one thing I when I talk to our threat intelligence guys all the time, it's like, well, I don't know that, and yeah. That's kind of interesting. What does that mean, though? And then explain it to me and go, okay, maybe that's not interesting, or maybe it's interesting. And so you're trying to find opportunities and ways. And so I think one of the things people need to do is don't underestimate the value of the data that you mm-hmm. think is
you're
you
not think your commonplace. You are not your own target demographic.
From a broad standpoint, right? Like, you make a product, you live and breathe a product, you do this thing every day. That's all you're about. But the people buying your product are not like that. That's
exactly the theme that Trishinsky and I spoke about last week.
Yeah, okay.
People outside your building do not know the problem space, your problem, or your products, your technologies and solutions. They don't even understand their own problems as well as you think they do.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where I think the data, you know, looping it back to the subject, the data can help them understand that in a very objective way and in a way that is accessible and truthful and without agenda.
Be good, get lucky. I think that's a mantra that applies to a lot of facets in life.
Be good, get lucky. You won't find a shorter summary. Thanks for tuning into this episode, and I hope you join us for the next one. Take care.